This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega. And for much of his political career, Joe Biden has been teased for his verbal gaffes and goofs, but he's not alone. Do you remember this eek moment from President Obama during his 2012 re-election campaign?
If you were successful, somebody along the line gave you some help. There was a great teacher somewhere in your life. Somebody helped to create this unbelievable American system that we had that allowed you to thrive. Somebody invested in roads and bridges. If you got a business, that you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen.
Ugh, I mean, you just knew what the soundbite was going to be and how it would get used.
You didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen.
Ooh, cringe. And listen, I'm not hating. This was fair game in a presidential campaign. But the focus of the soundbite deflected attention from the far more important part of what President Obama was saying here.
Somebody invested in roads and bridges.
And it's not just somebody who invested in roads and bridges. It was us, the American people. Throughout the 20th century, our government, on our behalf, in an overwhelmingly bipartisan fashion, made significant investments in our core infrastructure. They joined up with private industry and American workers and completed projects that so transformed our built environment and our way of life that honestly, they've kind of become invisible to us. Yes, I mean the railroads, interstates, bridges, highways, and levees. But also the curbs, gutters, sewers, drains, stoplights, and yes, even the yellow lines that divide traffic going opposite directions. This is the infrastructure that makes it possible for you to live 40 miles from where you work every day. It's how we stock grocery shelves. It's why you can have almost anything you imagine delivered directly to your 23rd floor apartment. And it's why we could vaccinate nearly half the adult population against a deadly pandemic in less than 6 months. But the invisible core of our nation is crumbling. In its 2021 report card, the American Society of Civil Engineers gave our national infrastructure a C-. But President Joe Biden has made infrastructure a significant policy priority of his new administration. Here's President Biden speaking last week about his ambitious bipartisan infrastructure deal.
I'm pleased to report that a bipartisan group of senators, five Democrats, five Republicans, part of a larger group, has come together and forged an agreement that will create millions of American jobs and modernize our American infrastructure to compete with the rest of the world and own the 21st century.
The agreement reached by the president and a group of moderate senators to spend $1.2 trillion over 8 years would be the largest investment in infrastructure in almost a century. But there's one question that Biden must be able to answer before Americans will enthusiastically endorse this plan. Why does it cost so much? To help us get behind the dollar sign soundbite and truly understand the cost of infrastructure is Jerusalem Demsis, policy reporter at Vox. Jerusalem, welcome back to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thrilled to have you back. And your piece was so helpful and useful in terms of thinking about this. So let's start with simply, what is infrastructure in 2021?
Sure. I think that's been a big question for especially Democrats and President Joe Biden. So, you know, traditionally people think of infrastructure as sort of the physical infrastructure you described, things like roads, bridges, gutters, curbs, water, mains. But infrastructure is supposed to be the basic underlying physical and organizational tools that we use in order to support the rest of our lives. And so the Biden administration is making the case that that should include things like broadband, that should include things like childcare and other priorities that they have. But, you know, I think it's less relevant what we call it and more relevant about whether or not the American people feel like it's a good use of taxpayer dollars.
So let's talk about that good use of dollars. Now, when we're thinking about how expensive this is, can you help us to understand how litigation costs actually drive up the cost of infrastructure?
Sure. The first thing I want to say right at the top, though, is we're going to be talking a lot about the why it costs so much to build in the United States. But sometimes people hear this conversation and they assume we need to, you know, slash budgets and that we're spending way too much money. But the United States actually spends very little of its GDP in comparison with our peer countries on infrastructure. We spend about 1.5% of our GDP on public infrastructure, while the UK spends 2%, France spends 2.4%, and Australia 3.5%. And actually, a lot of the problems we're going to talk about about stem from the fact that we're not willing to actually spend on the upfront costs to make sure that we're actually getting the best bang for our buck. With that said, litigation costs are a really big problem. So in 1970, the United States passes the National Environmental Protection Act. And the goal was to ensure that when federal dollars are being spent on either federal projects or private projects that needed a federal permit, which is the majority of projects in the United States that are big transit projects, that you need to make sure that you're not having some sort of negative environmental impact. And that's a really good, kind of goal to have. But what ends up happening is that that gets essentially hijacked by a bunch of people in order to stop construction projects that they just don't personally like, even if they benefit the entire community writ large. And to kind of just put that into perspective for you, essentially what happens is you have to create an environmental impact statement, an EIS. And the average EIS used to be as short as 10 pages. Now it's more than 1,600 pages and takes potentially 4.5 years to complete on average, which means that you're delaying by several years every time you're trying to build. And you know, that means that people can litigate and can actually make sure that projects that are good for the broader community never end up happening simply because they don't like the view, they don't want to deal with construction, things that are reasonable things to be upset about, but not ones that are reasonable to stop entire transit lines over.
Okay, let's just pause for a second. So you hear the word environmental impact study, and I'm thinking, let's make sure that you're not poisoning the water. Let's be sure that, you know, you're not, taking the habitat from animals that wouldn't otherwise have it. You're telling me that it's about the wealthy who are protecting their view?
Yeah. And in many cases, and, you know, this is a really big problem that several economists and several transit researchers have been pointing to for quite a long time. People have weaponized the process in order to protect their own interests. I grew up in Montgomery County, Maryland, and before I was even born, they were thinking of creating a transit line across the county. And a group of wealthy residents essentially began suing because they said that there was some sort of environmental impact, that there was some sort of potential species that would be at risk. They didn't have any evidence for this, and they ended up not having any evidence for it at all, and the courts didn't find any, but they ended up delaying the project for decades. It's still not built to this day, and it's something that would have benefited kind of lower income workers who need to get to the higher income areas quickly and don't have quick ways to get there right now. Domestic workers who live in one part of the county are having difficulty getting over to the other part of the county where the jobs are. And, you know, there's a lot of public comments that you can look through that show that a lot of times people are actually trying to protect the view from a country club, or they kind of are upset at the idea that there are lower income people or people from other counties who are going to be traveling through their area. So it becomes very clear that this has very little to do with the environment. And there are even more egregious examples. In California, they have their own version of this law called CEQA. Essentially, it's been used to protect parking lots, and so that people don't have to build bike lanes. I mean, these are things that are very clearly not environmentally friendly projects. It's been used to kill solar projects and wind projects. So very clearly, often it's not being used to protect the environment at all, but just the interests of wealthy Americans.
So I feel like you've built a really powerful story here, one where you're saying on the one hand, we talk about this as being expensive, but actually from a percentage basis, it's actually that we're not spending enough. But in order to spend more, we're going to need to tax some folks. And the people who have the money to tax are the same people who are already beginning to, or have been for a couple decades now, really standing in the way of these projects. So is there a way to tell the story, to drive the narrative, to organize folks in such a way that actually builds that sense of collective and communal, we have to build this together, which I think is what President Obama meant to say back in 2012?
I think two things. Firstly, I think that the idea that we necessarily have to tax people to spend on these kinds of projects is maybe not the case. We have extremely low interest rates right now, which means that borrowing essentially from the federal government's perspective is essentially we're giving away money by not borrowing at this point with interest rates low. Secondly, I would say that, you know, this has caused massive economic and environmental harms. And it's something that you know, President Biden came in with a mandate to tackle both of those crises. NYU researchers noted that There are studies that show building dense urban transit networks could increase aggregate economic growth by 10% across the country. That's wages for real people. That's making sure that people can actually get to their jobs. That's making sure that people who want to live in certain regions have a way to do so. And then on top of that, of course, we're talking about the environmental impacts here. There is no way to really combat climate change without ensuring that, especially in dense urban places, places like Boston, New York, Los Angeles, Seattle, San Francisco, DC, that in these places, people are able to get around without having cars and that they can make that choice without it being a massive cost to them. In many of these places, it is not possible to use mass transit and get to work on time in a reasonable way. Creating a system in which people can live in that space is very, very important. So I think making the case of both an economic and environmental one, but also realizing that even though I'm saying that it's protecting interests of some of these wealthy folks, a lot of it is a very small selection of people. Like when I was talking about those bike lanes that were stopped in San Francisco, that was one person. This is not like a mass movement of people who are using these things. Like this one person who delayed 2,000, bike lanes for several years. And during that time, 2,000 people ended up actually getting hit by a car when they didn't have a protected bike lane. So, I mean, that's what we're talking about here, is that fact that very, very small groups of people can hijack this. I don't think it's clear at all that the majority of wealthy people are opposed to transit or opposed to this kind of development.
That is so useful for understanding how this is operating. And I also feel like your economic analysis is a very useful way for us to think through this. So just tell us, are we getting a good return for each of the dollars that we spend on infrastructure projects?
I would say no. Right now, there are a lot of reasons for this. Americans, transit agencies don't have the incentive to kind of learn from other countries and to make sure that they are actually bringing things down to cost. A lot of that has to do with the fact that they're so underfunded. But just to give you some numbers, in New York, the Second Avenue subway cost $2.6 billion per mile. But in Copenhagen, they built a project at $323 million per mile. This is kind of massive differences in cost that have a real impact on how much cost overruns actually happen.
Jerusalem Demsis is a policy reporter at Vox. Jerusalem, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
Right now, I want to turn to a very different way of thinking about costs with one simple question. Are highways racist? Now, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg weighed in on this back in April in an interview with The Griot.
There is racism physically built into some of our highways.
But those comments were ridiculed by many conservatives online and condemned in the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal. Here to give us more context and help us understand the disproportionate burden of infrastructure development on communities of color is Robert Bullard, Distinguished Professor of Urban Planning and Environmental Policy at Texas Southern University. Professor Bullard, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So it's an odd way to put it, but let me just ask it this way. Are highways racist?
Well, highways are not racist, but highway policy planning has been used in a way that disproportionately impact people of color. And the triple whammy this infrastructure be in a way discriminatory is policy, planning, and funding. And the way it happens is that you can almost map which communities get the best infrastructure and which communities don't. And it tracks closely with race and income.
I was just talking with a reporter from Vox who was walking us through the idea that very small groups of wealthy, well-connected individuals have been able to stop, for example, mass transit projects, right, or even things like bike lanes because of what they're calling the environmental impacts, right? So holding these things up for years. And yet I'm thinking about your work in which whole communities were trying to address issues of real environmental impact. And often were just, you know, these projects were just done anyway. What is the asymmetry in power here?
Well, you know, America is segregated and so is pollution. And if you look at the way that people of color and the environmental justice community has used the National Environmental Policy Act, it's very different from the way that your guest described it. Many of our communities of color are fighting projects that run freeways through their living room or set dirty coal power plants next to their schools or chemical plants, refineries, And so we were able to get the National Environmental Policy Act to incorporate an environmental justice equity lens, whereas before it was just using the idea of environmental impacts. Environmental impacts are not distributed equally across the board. And the pollution follows people of color and racist planning and formulations.
So let's talk a little bit about highways. I know there's a recent example right there in Houston where you are with the proposed expansion of I-45. Can you tell me about that?
Well, if you look at highways, I wrote a book in 2004 called Highway Robbery, Transportation, Racism, and New Routes to Equity. Transportation and highways historically have been used to mow down communities and using eminent domain and other kinds of strategies. And I-45, which runs north and south, runs through Houston's historic Fifth Ward and Cashmere Garden, was impacted, 50 years ago. And this past year, there was a proposal to expand it. And so you're building on top of inequity. And so the idea was, no, we don't need to have another highway that's going to destroy this Black and brown community. And so the Secretary Pete Buttigieg weighed in and basically said, this is another form of environmental discrimination, environmental racism, and transportation racism. There's nothing, this is not new or news, but it's a unique in that this was, this happened as soon as he got into the cabinet.
Is there a way to address the infrastructure needs of the country in a way that is racially just and actually addresses the infrastructure needs of Black communities rather than just literally paving those over?
Yes, there is. I mean, we have a strategy called Justice 40 that we were able to get the administration to talk about, making sure that infrastructure and other investments and benefits go directly into those communities that need them. All infrastructure is not created equal. Just because you have a proposal to build a bridge or a road or a highway doesn't necessarily mean that that highway will benefit all communities in an equal way. In many cases, highways run through neighborhoods with a high portion of residents that don't even own cars, so there are very few benefits for that. When we talk about issues of parks, bridges, roads, schools, solid waste, stormwater, transit, wastewater, these are all infrastructure issues. And if you look at them in a way of which communities don't have adequate resources and funding, you can really predict where money should go. And it's no accident that many of our schools, for example, in our cities, infrastructure is in bad shape. Many of these schools are located next to, across the fence, or adjacent to chemical plants and refineries and other kinds of toxic facilities. And so that when we talk about infrastructure, it's more than roads and bridges. It's also talk about infrastructure for planning and our organizations to make sure that money, tax dollars follow need, as opposed to the way it really happens in the real world is money follows money, money follows power, and money follows whites. And so it's no accident that the more affluent communities have more of infrastructure, parks and green space, trees, and other kinds of amenities, whereas communities of color generally are barren. That's not just, that's not fair, and that's not the way that federal funds should be used.
Professor Robert Bullard, the Distinguished Professor of Urban Planning and Environmental Policy at Texas Southern University, thank you for your body of work and thank you for your clarity about what infrastructure is and how to do it in ways that are just.
Thank you.
Last week, President Biden and a bipartisan group of senators announced that they'd agreed to a $1.2 trillion infrastructure deal. But what happened in the days since is a little confusing, so stick with me here. Shortly after the agreement was announced, the president said the compromise agreement would only go through if a second infrastructure bill, which includes things like child care and health care, passes as well.
If only one comes to me, I'm not, if this is the only thing that comes to me, I'm not signing it. It's in tandem.
So those comments didn't sit well with the Republican senators who'd been part of the compromise. So after hearing their frustration, Biden had to walk back his comments and said he did not intend to threaten a veto. One of the lead negotiators on the Republican side, Senator Rob Portman from Ohio, says he was glad to see the president clarify his remarks.
We're all blindsided by the comments the previous day, which were that somehow these two bills were connected.
So are the two sides finally ready to move forward with this bill? Joining me now to explain all of this is Nick Fadnos, who is the congressional correspondent for the New York Times. Nick, welcome to The Takeaway.
So glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So help us just understand what is different in the two bills that are on the table right now.
It's helpful to step back and remember several months ago when President Biden rolled out two plans, the American Jobs Plan and the American Families Plan, that constituted his big sweeping economic and social agenda. And so these two bills are trying to go and enact most of that, turn most of it into legislation. But one of them is bipartisan and one of them is probably going to end up being Democrats only. And so the bipartisan bill is, things like kind of traditional infrastructure projects. There's a lot of money in there, tens and hundreds of millions of dollars for roads, for fixing up bridges, for, bringing high-speed internet both to cities and rural parts of the country that don't have it, to cleaning up water pipes, getting lead out of water pipes, investing in public transit, creating a network of electric vehicle charging stations. There's some climate resiliency money in there, but a lot of it looks like what an infrastructure bill, that Republicans and Democrats might have written 10 years ago would be with some updating. So that's the bill that we're talking about that was introduced last week. At the same time, though, Democrats are trying to put together their own bill that will go through a separate fast-track budget process that will mean they can do it without Republicans, that is more liberal and frankly, has more to do with social safety net programs, what they are calling human infrastructure. So that may well end up including money for healthcare workers, for daycare, for expanding Medicare, as well as potentially tax increases to pay for it, rolling back parts of Republicans' 2017 tax plan that really lowered rates for corporations and for people making capital gains and things like that. So the details of that plan are less particular right now, but they're probably going to be bigger, costlier things that Republicans wouldn't get on board with.
Is it surprising that a bipartisan deal of any kind is possible in today's Washington?
Anytime Republicans and Democrats can come together on something, it's surprising. And particularly here, given just the politics around President Biden's ambitions, Republicans feigned outrage when he said he was going to hold these two bills together in tandem. But, the president has not been shy about how ambitious his agenda is. And frankly, Republicans and Democrats were always going to have to make their own political calculations about whether it was beneficial or harmful to the country, but also to their own party's political chances to work with each other. And in that sense, I think, I was a little surprised that they decided to come together on this, because if the plan works out, Republicans are going to, in effect, be supporting part of President Biden's multi-trillion dollar agenda, a lot of which they don't support. And Democrats are going to be letting them, get credit for part of it, even if they won't go along with the whole loaf.
So, Nick, I feel like politics or political science 101, we learned earmarks, even though they seem bad, are good because Congress people want to build bridges and roads. And that allows us to get all these other things through by earmarking. And then earmarks went away. And along with it, so did a lot of the cooperative work that allowed people to make those deals. I mean, should Biden maybe be holding out to put the human infrastructure stuff in with the roads and bridges?
I think it's become clear over the last couple of months that he is simply never going to get the Republican votes that he would need to pass those kind of priorities through regular order. So that's what's led to, this kind of awkward two-track process where they're trying to move two big bills simultaneously, one with just the Democratic votes that will go through this other special process called budget reconciliation. And I think, whether or not he should hold up one bill for the other
I think maybe a debate for his advisors to have. But the reality is progressives on Capitol Hill who want to see Congress take their fleeting moment when they control all of Washington and do something really big are not going to let him just get away with or, you know, complete this process with just something small. I think they're going to throw some of their own weight around and try and get something really big done and say, you know, if Republicans aren't going to go along with it, well, you know, too bad for them. We can leave them on the sidelines altogether. We could try and put everything into a big reconciliation package. Now, that creates its own problems with moderate Democrats, Joe Manchin and others who we talk a lot about. But, you know, his allies and elements of the Democratic Party are going to be doing everything they can to make sure he goes as big as possible.
So going big also means paying a big bill. Where's the revenue coming from?
Yeah, so each of these bills have different the jargon on Capitol Hill is called pay-fors. In the bipartisan bill, they are, shall we say, creative and eclectic and more modest. So some of it is repurposing money from the big coronavirus relief packages that passed in 2020, money that never got spent or was meant for unemployment insurance, but then Republican governors canceled the program in many states. So that money would be set towards this. You know, there's other anticipations that the Biden administration would invest more in enforcement capacity for the IRS, and that would bring in increased tax revenue. That would help pay for some of this. Part of it, they're just making a bet that the economy is going to improve with this investment, and therefore tax revenues will be higher. Now, as I said, for the bigger, more ambitious Democratic bill, they're really looking to pay for that with tax increases on the rich and on corporations. And I think that's where, you know, the real money will come from, trillions of dollars in revenue.
Let's talk about the timeline a little bit. This is a lot of money and, you know, a bipartisan agreement. We've got a, you know, seems surprising, but the midterms are actually kind of around the corner. Folks already starting to raise money for their reelection campaigns. Will we see that money literally on the ground, right, on the roads and bridges soon and in enough time to make a difference moving towards midterms?
Well, that is certainly President Biden's hope. The schedule that leaders on Capitol Hill seem to be trying to set up right now is that the House and Senate are going to work really furiously up to their August recess and try and get this process maybe halfway done by then, and then come back in September and try and complete all their work before the month is over. The idea being that there are a lot of deadlines, actually, particularly for existing transportation programs that expire at the end of the month. And that they want to get these things in place. And as you say, get the money pumping out the door, because it takes a long time to spend millions, billions, and even trillions, you know, especially trillions of dollars. So the longer this goes, the harder it is. And frankly, I think it gets a little harder politically to corral the votes as well. So, you know, they're aiming for the end of September. We'll see. Deadlines have a way of really slipping on Capitol Hill.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. But also, if they need any help in spending millions, billions, and trillions, I totally have ideas about that. So Nick Fandos is a congressional correspondent for The New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. And let's be honest, right now I'm a bit of a mess. I'm wearing a $12 elastic waist, black cotton capris, and an $8 black cotton t-shirt. And yeah, I'm barefoot. When I have an important Zoom meeting, all I do is put on a blazer. Now, personally, I see this as a win. My ability to talk with y'all each day while looking like this is a reason radio is so much better than TV. But this is not how everyone has responded to the social isolation of quarantine. I have one friend, Janice Johnson Diaz, who stays on IG looking like quarantine has been her personal spa vacation. Like me, Janice is a professor, spouse, and mom in her 45 pluses. This year, she released her first book and completed a virtual book tour, and she looks amazing. So I asked her about it, and here's what she said.
I am determined for the people not to take any more from me. So the least I can do is make sure that I get myself all the way together in the middle of this pandemic. I'm gonna wear that clothes. I'm gonna master the lashes. I am gonna figure out how to contour. I'm gonna get into it. Each day I'm out here trying to figure out how I'm gonna be Zoom fly, or how, when I come out to see the people in their small groups and my mask, how I'm gonna be fly without lipstick. So it's a thing when you're 49 plus, you have to remember the good old days, that there is still a little flyness in you, even in the midst of this craziness that is America.
So I've been thinking, just what are the new standards of grooming, beauty, and fashion? Are we facing a season of MHP frump or an era of Janice Johnson Diaz fly? Joining me now is Darian Simone Harvin, a reporter covering beauty at the intersection of politics and pop culture. She also writes the newsletter Beauty IRL. Darian, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited for this conversation.
What happened even with our definition of beauty over the course of the past year and a half of the pandemic?
Ooh, yes. If wellness, self-care was already not a part of the beauty conversation, it now is the dominating conversation. I think that a lot of times when kind of thinking about this from the perspective of not the industry, but more of, you know, a consumer, for lack of a better word, just as a person, the person walking down the Target aisle, something for the past year we have not been able to do at the leisure that we may want to. I think that now the definition of beauty has broadened to also question how we are taking care of ourselves. And so I think that as we saw a decrease in certain sectors of beauty, beauty is a resilient industry. You know, revenue and the monetary value in comparison to whether it be groceries or fashion or personal care products, I think that out of all of them, you know, beauty is the most resilient. And so as much as we saw maybe a hit within maybe a makeup or a decrease in lipstick sales, we also saw an increase in personal care products now being viewed as a part of our beauty regimen, from our body oils to our body lotions to also DIY, thinking about press-on nails and doing your own gel, your gel manicures, things like that became popular. And so I think it has almost been a more of a looking yourself in the mirror. And I also think that a lot of people who thought that they didn't care as much about that hair color or that haircut realize that they do. And it affects the way that they look at themselves, you know, whether it's on Zoom or in real life now.
So let's talk a little bit about what we're buying, because it did feel like a weird year. So I heard you talk about lipstick. So on one hand, like when you're out in public, you were masked during the winter months, right? You also had a hat down. So it wasn't as though people out in the world could see you. But on the other hand, Zoom was really intimate, right? People all up in your pores and your eyebrows. So talk to me about what parts of, for example, our face or of our hands, maybe we got more focused on this year.
Yes. Oh, this conversation is so nuanced and so personal, but there are definitely some trends that we saw as our collective lifestyles change, particularly around work, this environment where we did feel that we had to show up in a certain way between January 2020 and mid-March. So this is during mid-March was essentially when most states within the U.S. went on lockdown. Zoom usage jumped 67%. And so that directly affected the way that literally people viewed their faces. and how that is different from the mirror. It's different from even your phone. And it made people really think about getting procedures done, whether it is something around maybe that takes more of a healing time and is more invasive, such as like a nose job, or maybe it's something around Botox. You know, now I think that within the world of plastic surgery, we are seeing that also there are these regimens or these services that you can do that's not quite Botox or it's not quite a lift. It's something that may be temporary. And so we saw an increase of people exploring those options and really kind of basically asking the question, do I look the way I think I looked?
No, it's true. Typically, if you are speaking to a group of people, you're not also looking at a reflection of yourself as you're having that conversation. It's very disconcerting in a way. It makes it harder to forget what you look like and just be in your head, because there you are staring at yourself while you're talking. I'm wondering if we know anything about that connection, the kind of Zoom impact of looking at yourself while you're, you know, trying to work, and what that's meant for the other part of our beauty, our bodies, mm-hmm. right? Are we carrying the stress in our bodies? Are we putting on weight? Are we taking off weight?
I wrote a piece for Allure, and I was able just to talk to a variety of women and femmes across ages, right? And I think that something that I did feel was a common thread, all of us were looking ourselves in the mirror longer or on Zoom, and our reactions were different. I spoke to a woman who she routinely got her hair colored because of the grays. Now, you know, she kind of realized like, hey, this is who I am. I'm going to continue to wear my gray and to rock it. And I think that actually all of those things are still connected to beauty and taking care of yourself, even mentally. And kind of, we feel that and are sometimes required by society to look a certain way. And so I think that within that respect, people have new perspectives that I think are attached to wellness. And so maybe as we saw a decrease in hair coloring, is an increase in hair care. So people are just looking to take care of their hair more from the inside out. We also saw an increase in sales of body washes, soaps and lotion. And this is all according to McKinsey in a recent report that they came out with on how COVID is changing the world of beauty. I do think that the beauty industry has worked to address these sentiments. Yeah, some people are looking in the mirror and saying, hey, I want to get this procedure done. And other people are like, you know what, I'm going to grow out my gray hair, and because I'm focusing on my skincare now more, you know, I haven't bought that hair color yet. I'm not going back to the hair salon as often as I did.
So obviously the pandemic marked so much of what this year was, but another critical aspect over the course of the past year has been the movement for racial justice. How has that shown up in our beauty standards and our beauty purchasing?
The death of George Floyd, the awareness of the death of Breonna Taylor, really in conjunction with us being during this time where people really had to sit with this idea of not always centering themselves and their problems every day, really allowed people to take the idea and the responsibility that they feel that brands have to being ethical to a whole new level. I think that people were already looking for brands to be transparent, but it was more around ingredients and it was more around what I'm putting on my skin. And now I think that people want to know who the founder is. They want to know what you believe in. They want to see that you support people of color in some way. They want to know the racial makeup of your corporate office. And so all of these things now people feel are how brands now need to compensate for how they have attributed to systemic racism. And so I think that where people are at now is that people are essentially trying to figure out the role that brands are supposed to be playing in social justice and in improving the world. And that is something that I don't even think I have the answer to either. You know, I think that we kind of look to brands as being the voices, but I don't think that they're actually equipped to be our voices.
So we had a conversation on the show earlier this week about TikTok and TikTok dance creators and the strike relative to white TikTokers using the creative production of Black creators. And I've been thinking about this relative to beauty as well, and the ways that Black women's aesthetic might get picked up by folks outside of community. Could this be a problematic side of the movement for social justice when we see an appropriation of beauty norms and standards?
Oh, that's an interesting question, because I think I'm kind of thinking about the world of natural beauty and clean beauty, and how when you look at the, I think, both indigenous practices, but also the practices of people of color, and how we have sourced our beauty. I think that there are some ingredients or rituals or now even plants that are becoming popular now that have been popular already amongst Black folks now. And so I think that what we're ultimately probably going to start to now see more is more of that. And it actually makes me always think about this moment, and we're kind of, again, tying it back to pop culture, appropriation. I think back to Zendaya, who remember when she wore dreadlocks to, or she wore faux locks to the Oscars. I'm blanking on the which year it was, but Juliana Rancic was a host of host on E! And also a part of Fashion Police. She talked about how it looked like she smelled of weed and patchouli oil. And ooh, essentially, do you remember that this happened?
I do. I think I blocked that out.
Yes. And weed and patchouli oil, I think she may have said cannabis and patchouli oil, but essentially the point was that it looked like she was carrying this vibe, or she looked Rastafarian, or she was, you know, from the earth. And now we're starting to see, you know, a continuation of, we love coconut oil. We love a shea butter now. Patchouli is now a popular fragrance ingredient, and really always has been. So I think that, again, there are a lot of very, very interesting ties. And when we look at kind of tying it back to TikTok some, and looking at, you know, Black creators being on strike, so much of it is about dance, but a lot of it is about aesthetic too, and how you are able to use voices to own a persona or to own a look. And I think that we have a lot of people right now who are doing that just for, and thinking it's just for fun, and other people who are saying, hold up now, you know, it feels like you're taking some of my identity, and I want to know why you have a million views for it.
Now, last question. I just want to tie this back to politics a little. There are some pop culture icons who we're always looking to for beauty tips, but I'm wondering if there are political ones. I know you've written about the Michelle Obama bounce, but I'm wondering if we are seeing that, for example, with VP Harris, or if there are other people in the political realm marking what is beautiful.
Yes, absolutely. I think that it is often done in these very subtle ways. And so I think that I kind of look at someone like VP, Kamala Harris, who she has ultimately worn the same hairstyle for years. I think that we've seen these throwback photos of her in, you know, the 80s or the 90s, where maybe she had a shorter cut or a different color or whatever it may be. But now we very much associate her hair, I think, with just her image and who she is. And it's funny because I was just watching this TikTok, and it was basically this girl talking about Kamala Harris' hair. And I think that there's still such a beauty in like a consistency. Like, she clearly has, you can tell she's been wearing her hair like this for a long time, because she knows how to take care of it, or she knows how it'll look. It's kind of her fail-proof look. So I think it will be interesting if and when she ever makes these changes, and to see how people react, because a lot of times it's normally, I think that a lot of the beauty practices that are done within the political realm often end up being practical ones. I think also somebody like AOC, who actually really does and has talked about the power of beauty and how the way that she decides to present herself, especially in the political realm, I think is about symbolism and resistance to some degree. I think we've seen it both in their fashion when certain members decide to wear white, but also AOC, she has a red lipstick that she's known for. I also think about people like Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who decided to just go bald and to no longer wear wigs or extensions because she has alopecia. That is a beauty choice, especially within this realm where Black women's looks are policed not only in the workplace, but also just out in society, you know? And so I think that those are probably the main people who I am always paying attention to. And I also think it's really interesting to also think about politicians who either identify as non-binary and trans. And I think that particularly makeup and beauty has been an armor for them to, as a way to always express themselves, not just in politics. But I think it's particularly interesting in politics in this world where it is about suits and you know, not being too crazy with your hair or whatever it may be. I also think Nicole Hannah Jones, author, investigative reporter, leader of the 1619 Project, who has continuously wore bright red hair in this world of a world that we come from. And we know that bright red hair is not the norm. And sometimes people question how serious you are or literally how good at your job you are if you have a hair color that may not seem like that, that is more vibrant. And so there are these choices that we do make here and there.
I love that you brought us to Nicole Hannah Jones, and I adore that you brought us Tyana Presley, because she is what gave me the courage to shave my head. But turns out my head isn't shaped nearly as beautifully as Rep Presley's. Darian Simone Harvin is a reporter covering beauty at the intersection of politics and pop culture. She also writes the newsletter Beauty IRL. Darian, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our show for today, y'all. I really hope you enjoyed it, and I appreciate you tuning in. Call us with your ideas and suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.